Romans chapter 12, a series, if you remember, that I've called Living True, how to build a life on God's mercy, in line with God's mercy, I should say. We are now doing the last part of Romans 12, so we're starting at verse 14 and working through to verse 21. The Apostle Paul writes, "Bless those who persecute you. Don't curse them. Pray that God will bless them. Be happy with those who are happy, and weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people. And don't think you know it all. Never pay back evil with more evil. Do things in such a way that everyone will see you are honourable. Do all that you can to live in peace with everyone. Dear friends, never take revenge. Leave that to the righteous anger of God. For the scriptures say, 'I will take revenge, I will pay them back,' says the Lord. Instead, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. In doing this, you'll heap burning coals of shame on their heads. Don't let evil conquer you, but conquer evil by doing good." So we've looked at, so far, worship and grace and love. Today, another big theme, another big word. We're looking at peace today. Peace. And it's true, isn't it? Everyone loves a bit of peace. You know, when the kids keep bickering and the dog keeps barking and the phone doesn't stop ringing, maybe the door never stops knocking in your office, or the emails never stop appearing, or your pager keeps bleeping. All you want is a little bit of peace sometimes. You want some quiet that restores your soul, restores your mind, restores your body. And that certainly is one kind of peace, and it is a kind of peace actually that the Bible values highly, and puts also links in with the gospel. But today I'm looking at another kind of peace. A kind of peace which may be at a national level. It's almost imperceptible to us, but yet we've been enjoying it for years. A peace which, if you were in Syria, Nigeria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, you'd be very eager to have, wouldn't you? The kind of peace that is about an absence of conflict, a ceasing of hostility. So, isn't it wonderful that today we live in a nation which is at peace and has been at peace, really, since the end of the Second World War? But what might be true on a national level isn't necessarily true on a personal level. That we still all experience conflict on a personal level. It might be that dispute you're having with your neighbour over the fence. It might be something in your family which people fell out about years ago, and it's just run on and on and on, and now divides your family. It could be that actually in your home with your spouse, you're experiencing conflict. You're wanting different things. All kinds of different situations I think you can imagine. The scripture today speaks to us, I don't think at a national level, I think it speaks to us at a personal, at a community, at a church level. And it encourages us to be peaceful people. So what do I mean by that? I mean somebody who brings peace into a situation. Somebody who pulls the rug out from under the feet of conflict. Let me give you a different image. You've probably, like me, been on a ferry. You might have stood on the top deck looking out over the bow, and you see the wake of the boat. You can look back and you can see in the water the kind of the bubbles or whatever, where the ferry's been. lives that perhaps are normally there. So a boat leaves a wake. I would say a peaceful person also leaves a wake, but it's kind of the opposite to that. In that where the boat churns up the water, where the boat makes waves, a peaceful person calms the water and stills the waves. Imagine that. Imagine being on the back of your ferry or something, and you're seeing waves all around the boat, but where the ferry's been, it's completely still and smooth. That's what a peaceful person does. Today I'm not talking about peace brokers, maybe like Jesus was talking about in his Sermon on the Mount, where he said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." I think of that in terms of brokering peace. You know, two people are falling out. That's what a peacemaker does. But I'm thinking today about then somebody who leaves a trail of peace. I think today in our culture, we have a culture of sensation, of headline grabbing. And people like to be the one who makes waves and stirs things up. It doesn't matter if you're the person who says unpopular things in order to grab the headlines. It doesn't matter if you are the woman on the red carpet in the revealing gown. You want to make waves. You want people to notice you. You want to stand out. You're not interested in peace. You want to draw attention to yourself. You say or do things to get noticed, to assert yourself. Maybe you're the guy in the pub who is always on their feet in someone else's face, trying to assert their power, if you like, their strength. Peaceful people are not like that. Peaceful people are the calming influences. Peaceful people are the ones who shape, who even form communities. And far from being objectionable, they are approachable people. This week I read the parable of the yeast. Jesus tells a story, really, really simple. He says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a woman who worked yeast into her flour. It only took a little bit, but it spread all through the dough." And I know that Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven and the way that the kingdom of heaven works. But I think peace is part of that. And our peacefulness then, a little bit of peace from us, can work all through the dough. A little bit of peace amongst God's people in the neighbourhood can have a dramatic effect. So today we're going to look at peace. We're going to look at what it takes to be a peaceful person, or what it looks like to be a peaceful person. And Paul, writing under inspiration by the Holy Spirit, gives us some really helpful advice. The first thing then that I think, I feel that maybe he talks about, verse 14 to 16, is that peace takes humility. Humility is at the heart of peace. Earlier on in verse 3, you might remember from a few weeks back, he talked about honest self-evaluation and how then, because when we are honestly and we self-evaluate ourselves, we end up being humble because we realise, hey, we're not that. In verse 16, you can see there's a couple of little words. The company of ordinary people. Ordinary, there, is basically the word for humility. So peace takes humility. And I think it's, Paul directs us in three ways. Firstly, in terms of our words. He says in verse 14 about blessing and cursing. How we shouldn't curse those who persecute us, but bless them instead. My thoughts kind of went to the working world and thinking, well, when your boss lays into you at work, what do you do? Do you curse them to their face? Do you have a go at them back? Do you curse them behind their back? is that you bless them, isn't it? Maybe you refuse to speak badly about them. When other colleagues are doing so, you refuse to do that. Maybe you affirm the good in them. Yes, I know he was like that this morning. I know that they can often be about that. But perhaps she's had something going on in her life that we don't know about, and it's just blowing everything out of proportion for her. Maybe you wish them a nice weekend. Have a good holiday. Not just for the sake of it. When I think of Jesus, then I think about him, as we, again, a few weeks back, we read from Luke 23, him being crucified and praying at his crucifixion, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing." This is Jesus blessing people who any of us would curse. Jesus lived what he preached. These words Paul uses, not exactly Jesus's, but when you read Jesus in Matthew and read Jesus in Luke, you can quite see that this is something which has been passed down from Jesus' teaching to Paul, and Paul is reusing it here. So, words would be the first thing. Emotions might be a second thing. Humility and emotions. Paul talks about sharing in other people's joys and their sorrows in verse 15, doesn't he? We spoke last week about unhypocritical love. And here is a love that empathizes. It actively empathizes with people. What it doesn't do, it doesn't envy success. Nor does it evade people when they're in distress. It doesn't grimace when somebody is, in our eyes, an unworthy winner. It doesn't pity people. There's a difference between empathy and sympathy. Sympathy can smack a bit of pity. And sometimes that smacks a bit I'm glad it was not me. It's you going through this, not me. That's not what empathy does. Jesus famously wept at Lazarus' tomb in John chapter 11. But he wasn't there alone. He was weeping alongside Mary. There were others there too. With neighbours, family, whatever. They were weeping as well. Jesus entered into their weeping with them. So words and emotions, and the third one might be attitudes. Paul speaks about living in harmony with each other. What does that mean? What's harmonious living? I don't think it necessarily means agreeing with everybody all the time. Just going along, being a yes man, you know, nodding at everything and saying, "Oh yeah." I think what Paul's trying to drive at is the sense of valuing everybody the same. So that when I look around this room, I don't see people who I think are more important than people who I think are less important. I value everybody the same. And you do the same. You value everyone else the same. That's how we live in harmony with one another. We have our differences. We're going to vote different ways in the election in a few weeks' time. Trust me. Of advice essentially then is this. He says, don't rate the high things, but associate with the low. The NLT puts it, don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people. Don't rate the high things, but associate with the low. You could even push the words here, Paul's words here, enough to say it means get carried away with the ordinary. People get carried away with the extraordinary, don't they? Wow, they're so amazing. Celebrity. Jesus didn't. He got carried away with the ordinary. Ah, there's a tax collector. I must go and have a party with them. And that's what he did, wasn't it? Jesus didn't hang around with the great and the good. He hung around with the ordinary. He partied with tax collectors and prostitutes, according to Mark chapter 2. This was dubious company for a religious teacher, wasn't it? Yet this is what he did because Jesus was humble. And peace, peacefulness, takes humility. Verses 17 and 18. Paul mentions in verse 17, doing things in such a way that everyone can see you are honourable. There's something about peacefulness that is visible. Another Bible translation puts it like this: think through what will seem good to everybody who is watching. Think through what will seem good to everybody who's watching. Like me, you would have had that person who says to you, call yourself a Christian. Well, why do they say that? Because they are watching. They are watching you. And so Paul encourages us to exercise forethought about what we do, to put care and effort and attention into it, to think about how it looks to people. Now, the question of how it looks can be hypocrisy, can't it? Jesus warned about that. He criticized the Pharisees for praying in the streets in a great way to draw attention to themselves, or the way that they put money into the offerings, and that kind of thing. Hypocrisy is when you look good on the outside, but inside there's something wrong. But if your heart is good, isn't the outside going to look good as well? To borrow another of Jesus' phrases, he says, by their fruits you'll recognise them. In other words, people live out what's in their hearts. You don't pick grapes from thorn bushes, Jesus says. People can see grapes. They know it's on a vine. They know it's not on a thorn bush. People are watching us then. People are watching for that fruit to judge our hearts and judge our faith. So what matters here is doing what is good, and for people to be able to see it. In Greek, there's two words for good. One is that core of moral goodness. Something is good because it is. The other word is a word that implies beauty. The best kind of English equivalent would be something like fine. You know, oh, that's a fine jacket you're wearing, Ivor. You know, that kind of thing. It's about quality, it's about appearance. You know? We sometimes use it in a funny way. We say, oh, that's another fine mess you've got me into, Stanley. You know? And what he means is that's a really cracking mess, you know, really good quality. Everyone can see it's a real mess. That's what he means, isn't it? So what we need to be careful of is not that deliberate hypocrisy that Jesus was speaking against, where we appear better and we do so for our good. But instead, what we do is good because we love what is good and we want to live by what is good. And the things that we're doing for other people's good, not for ours. There's no hypocrisy in that. We are, aren't we? Do you remember back to the first week again? Recipients of God's mercy. We're wanting to build this line in life in line with God's mercy. And God says, or Paul says, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. The way that you live, make it good, therefore. Let people see it. Don't impress them. Try to impress them with empty religion. Express peace through your lives. somebody is not nice to me. My tendency is to kind of shut down, to do nothing. I was always told as a kid, when in terms of bullies, when they're saying things to you that's not nice, just ignore them. But Paul has said, and Jesus is saying, bless those who persecute you. That's an active thing. So I'm not let off the hook by ignoring people or doing nothing. I have to do something that's proactive. Doing nothing's not an option. And again, just looking at these verses, verses 17 and 18, you can see the word everyone there twice. And also in that first verse, never pay back evil with more evil. It says effectively, to nobody pay back evil with more evil. So one, nobody, and two, everybody's, that basically encompasses everyone, doesn't it? That doesn't let me off at all. Paul hasn't said, well, apart from them, that you can behave differently with them. No, it's everybody. I'm called to share peace with everybody. Just as Paul will later write to the Colossians and say that Jesus died in order to reconcile the world to God. That this God who we had sinned against and turned our backs on and everything didn't do nothing. He didn't ignore us. He wasn't passive. He was proactive and he sent Jesus. That loving God that drives him to do all that it can to create peace. That is the same thing that Paul wants to see in the church. So we talked about peace-taking humility and peace-creating beauty. The third thing is this. Verses 19 to 21. Peace trusts God. Peace trusts God. There's an interesting phrase in here. Not just don't take revenge, but leave that, leave room for the righteous anger of God. What's Paul talking about there? I think the main thing would be justice, wouldn't it? When you are aggrieved, what you want to do is you want to get revenge. You want to get even. You want to settle the score. You know, even in our house on Friday, one of the kids talking about school and something that has happened, something somebody had done to them, and they said, I want to get back for that. So is revenge, is that just a childish thing? Oh no, because of course being a kid, you know, what happened was relatively minor. But for us as grown-ups, we have these more grievous things that we hold on to longer. And we have to admit that as grown-ups we're no better. We have what I think is a right sense of justice needing to be done. When you suffer injustice, what you want to see is justice. I think that's an inbuilt part of who we are. But we have this personal sense of getting even. Or sometimes more than even. It's amazing how quickly kids learn the business of fairness, and they start saying, well, it's not fair, this and that, it's not fair. They know when they when someone's being fair, they know too when they're getting a good deal, and then they keep quiet. But the purpose of justice, or the purpose rather of revenge, is to satisfy our ego and our pride that's hurt, rather than some kind of greater or better sense of justice. Now, peace is different. quotes from Deuteronomy 32 and says, I will take revenge, I will pay them back, says the Lord. And he encourages us as Christians to trust that. He knows that Christians are persecuted. Maybe at this point, not on a kind of political scale, but locally, you know, people could still make things hard for you, for abandoning the old ways and becoming a Christian. But Paul's saying, trust God to avenge. It's going to happen at his time, in his place, in his way. It might happen before death, it could happen after death. But God is just. So how are we as peaceful people, how are we going to live? Well, maybe what we don't do is spread rumour. Maybe what we don't do is let our fists fly or our mouths rip. I had a housemate at university who, when someone had said something to him that he didn't like, he ran round all the other people that he knew to tell them about it and get them on his side. And yet Paul says, hey, remember that proverb? Remember there's an alternative. If your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. Identify their needs, respond to them. Show them grace, if you like. The call is to do good to those who would attack us. Why? In order to shame them. Is that because we want to be nasty? No. Because what we want to do is foster peace. So maybe you can get somebody to change the way they're behaving, not by force, not by evil, but actually by doing them good. What we are doing, when we take that proverb to heart, is that we are trusting that grace is more powerful than hate. And that is exactly what happened in the gospel, isn't it? That is exactly what happens with Jesus. We learn through the Bible that we were God's enemies before Christ came. We were his enemies. We were not at peace with God. We were his enemies. And then Jesus came, and this cross of Jesus, it quenched our thirst and fed our hunger, which is basically what this table represents, isn't it? Spiritual thirst, spiritual hunger. We think of Jesus saying, this is my body, this is my blood. In the cross thing, God heaps coals of shame on our heads and said, why do you hate me? Look at the good that I do you. We were sinners hating the lover of our souls, but then he put these burning coals on our heads. The fact that he does us good, the fact he sent Jesus for us and takes all the sin away and everything else, even though we were his enemies, until his peace burned into our minds, we realized that's wonderful. That is grace. That is what God is really like. Peace trusts God. Wonder what shoes you've got on today. I remember standing up here one day and I had my walking boots on. You couldn't really tell they were walking boots until I pulled the trousers up, but I did something. I waved my foot in the air like this. I remember Tim Bonges, if everyone remembers Tim, coming to me afterwards and saying, well, we all saw your walking boots this morning, didn't we? Anyway, I don't know if anybody... Is anyone wearing trainers today? Yeah? Anybody wearing Nike trainers? Yeah, Nike trainers. Well done. Do you know, in Paul's day, and even today, if you go to Athens, if you go up on the Acropolis, you go up to the Parthenon, you'll find there a statue of Athene Nike. She's not wearing trainers. Nike is the ancient Greek word for victory. The ancient inhabitants of Athens were a sea-going nation. Athene was their patron mass, their patron god, if you like, and they would wage war using their boats, and they would win, and they'd come home to Athens, into the Piraeus harbour, they'd walk up the hill, up to the Acropolis, and they would sacrifice and honour her and everything. Nike is the word for conquer. It's the word for winning a battle. It's the word that you get in verse 21 here. Now, Paul is writing to Christians in Rome about peace. And Christians in Rome would know all about Roman peace. It was a buzz phrase, a bit like strong and stable government. Pax Romana, it was called. And it was gained with an iron fist. It was gained by victory in war. It was kept by the use of force. The Romans would essentially beat you into submission. And then there'd be peace. Hooray! One of the ancient authors wrote about, he used this line. He said, they create a desert and call it peace. I love that idea. Really sums it up well. They create a desert, annihilate everything. Oh, isn't it peaceful here? Yes, of course it is. You just annihilated everything. That's the culture in Rome. That peace comes by winning, by beating your enemies. It can probably happen on a social level as well. It's all about social climbing in Rome. Christian peace is different. Paul says it comes not by overcoming enemies, but by loving them, by doing them good. That's because Paul knows that our real enemy is not people. Our real enemy is our egos, that sinful nature that he speaks about. The evil inside us that wants to assert ourselves as the winners. And I think for a Christian church today, that means we have to think carefully about where our enemies really are. Because our enemy actually isn't Richard Dawkins and the militant atheists. They do oppose the church. We are angry over how they misrepresent God. But they are not our enemies. Our anger is. We may feel under threat from Stonewall and all the gay lobbying groups. Our fear might be that our culture is changing beyond our control, that godliness is being lost. But our enemy is fear, it's not actually them. We might feel that our enemy is Islam and Eastern religions. But it's our xenophobia that keeps us from engaging with them as people. One author that just said this, one of the commentators, he said that we needed to be wary of baptizing our wrong attitudes under the name of righteousness. Because the gospel's clear that our response is to love our enemies and to bless those who persecute us. We don't agree with them, we bless people. And that is what we're called to do.